100 years since the outbreak of the First World War, a brutal conflict in which an estimated 15 million people lost their lives. Where I grew up in Britain, the First World War is a familiar story, marked by countless memorials and popular poems. But as a child of Punjabi migrants, I want to know how it's remembered in India. What impact it had on the lives of ordinary people here, and why between 1914 and 1918, so many Indian men were recruited for a war being fought thousands of miles from home. I'm Anita Rani. For the BBC World Service, this is India's Forgotten War.
The popular conception in India today is that it wasn't India's war because, you know, it was a colonial war that broke out in Europe between two European imperial powers. And India, really speaking, had no part in that quarrel.
Long years in the trench warfare. Some were successful who were lucky enough to return back, and many didn't come back at all.
Every day, lots of the world's people are being killed. And heaps of regiments and even brigades and divisions are being finished. This is not a war, this is a Mahabharat, and a great destruction of the world which is taking place. For the whole of India is being finished.
It was on 6th of December at the Battle of Cambrai where he was wounded.
So he died on the battlefield?
On the battlefield on 8th of December 1917.
At the United Services Institution in Delhi, a World War I commemoration is bringing together a few people whose relatives served in the war.
This is my grandfather, Subedar Neki Ram. In 1914 war, he was killed in France on the 23rd of November 1914. This is the letter, a letter of condolences. My grandmother, illiterate, she received this condolence messages from there.
And so there is a letter here signed.
Yes,
It says, I join with my grateful people in sending you this memorial of a brave life given for others in the Great War.
Right.
Signed, George.
That is very sad. Very sad.
The most visible monument to the First World War in India is now one of the country's most famous landmarks.
Hello. So I'm in the presidential area of Delhi with Rajpati Bhavan at one end of this very long, magnificent road, which is the Halls of Power. And at the other end, which is what I'm approaching now, is India Gate.
The huge stone arch of India Gate was unveiled in 1931 to commemorate some 70,000 men from pre-partition India who lost their lives during the war.
This monument is enormous and it is covered in names. On the outside walls, on the inner walls, inside the arches, every bit of stone has got a name of a dead soldier written on it. Jola Singh, Kaim Singh, Kebar Singh, Lal Hussein, Lal Khan, that's interesting. Sikhs and Muslims together fighting side by side in the same regiment. And across the top, it says India. To the dead of the Indian armies who fell and are honoured in France and Flanders, Mesopotamia, Persia, East Africa, Gallipoli and elsewhere. I wonder how many people who were here having their picture taken in front of it actually know why it was erected.
Why? This is a symbol of bravery. This is the symbol of our soldiers who died in a war 1971.
It's for a Kargil war.
Kargil war?
Independent war for India is a freedom fighter. 1999. Also for freedom of independence of India in 1947.
India Gate is a famous country, na? Delhi. So India Gate usi mein hi aata hai.
He doesn't know. He said, I don't know. He says, it's because it's a famous country.
Yes.
This is a historical monument.
This is to honor the Indian army.
Indian men who sacrificed their life for India.
Why is there no memory of World War I in India? I think part of the reason is India as a nation and as a society, we have no memories of any conflict before 1947.
Rana China is a historian at the Center for Armed Forces Historical Research.
After independence, anything that happened prior to 1947, when we gained that independence, was seen as being part of our colonial history and not something that was anything that the Indian state needed to engage with. Although I think that view is changing now and we have sufficiently matured as a nation, come out of the shadow of our colonial past to reclaim some of these histories.
India sent overseas for the war efforts 622,000 soldiers and 474,000 non-combatants, and a total of 1.5 million were recruited in India during the war years.
So how did India get involved in the first place? Dr. Shantanu Das is writing a book about India and the war.
The First World War breaks out. Britain declares war on 4th of August 1914. India immediately is co-opted into the war. India joins the war as part of the British Empire, and none of the Indian politicians were even consulted. And King George V, he then issues this proclamation to the people and the princes of my Indian Empire, asking them to help. What is extraordinary is the support from the middle-class political bourgeoisie. They completely supported the war effort, and they pledged their wholehearted and unconditional support to the British Raj. And even nationalists said that while the war lasted, they should put the cause of the empire before them. But always there was a strategic thinking that India will give its men, its money, its horses, its munitions. But in return, can it expect some greater political autonomy?
In 1914, the Western Front became a battleground over territory in Europe between Germany and the Allied forces of France and Britain. When British forces found themselves outnumbered, the existing army in India provided ready-made support.
The Indian Army had seen active service on the Northwest Frontier, in Africa, China, Somalia, which none of the other Commonwealth armies had seen. When the war broke out, Britain suddenly found itself on the back foot militarily. The BEF, or the British Expeditionary Force in France, found itself hard-pressed by the Germans. Two infantry divisions and a cavalry brigade were sent to France and Flanders.
India's Royal States were also called on for help.
You had British India, which was administered directly under the Crown, but then you also had over 500 princely states, and these could vary in size from maybe a few square kilometers to states about as big as France. Many of these princely states had their own armies, and parts of those armies were offered for service under the Crown in times of need, and they were known as Imperial Service Troops.
The princes, my God, they started competing with each other about their donations. They contributed an enormous variety of things, from money, people, horses, aeroplanes, too. I came across in an archival record, mufflers, socks, chocolates, tobaccos, you name it, he gives it.
And these guys were not even the multimillionaires, they were the billionaires of the day, weren't
they? Absolutely. And each according to his own status and capability, but there's enormous amounts of money that was given to the war efforts by the princely states.
My grandfather visited the front a number of times to encourage the Sikh troops and the Punjabi troops.
Retired Brigadier Sukhjit Singh's grandfather, the Maharaja of Kapurthala, offered men from his army to support the war.
My grandfather was an honorary colonel in the Sikh regiment because he was a Sikh ruler from Sikh state. So in those days, the rulers of Indian states were given honorary titles.
So what was happening at the time in India that members of royal families, it wasn't just in Punjab, around were so willing to fight with the Brits? What was in it for them?
Well, I think because after all, the princely states were there as a result of the proclamation of Queen Victoria after the Honourable East India Company was displaced by direct rule under the crown. And the undertakings and guarantees that she gave the Indian princes naturally assured the crown of a certain commensurate loyalty. And India as such was something intangible. They couldn't conceive of it at that level. So they brought it down to an easily digestible level, the regimental level. Because after when the chips are down, even in all armies, the final call is what? Honor of the clan, the honor of your faith, or whatever. And you can call upon a human being to give the most ultimate sacrifice.
This photograph has got embossing of Paris studio. This is the original, it has got Paris, it was taken in Paris.
Lieutenant Colonel Thakur Aman Singh Jodha served with the Jodhpur Lancers, an Imperial Service cavalry unit sent to Europe in 1914. The Lieutenant Colonel's grandson, M.S. Jodha.
Because of the war, he got more prominence. He was decorated with the Order of British India on 20th April 1917 in France.
And what have you got in your hand here?
These are the coins from 1914 to 1920. Like the pay of the officers that time and the men used to come in this British India silver coins. Somebody got lesser money and some got more, depending on the rank and experience and service.
So let's have a look at these coins. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 British silver. There are 1 rupee India 1916. On the flip side, it's George V, King Emperor.
Yeah.
Gosh.
These are 7 coins from 1914 till 1920, all war years. Like the Jodhpur Lancers remained in Aleppo after the war as forces of occupation. They only came back in February 20.
So what were they fighting for? What were all these 1.5 million Indians? Mm-hmm. What cause were they fighting for?
As far as the common soldier was concerned, he didn't know what was the cause, where is he going, why is he going. He didn't question any of these things. For the soldier of the Jodhpur, it was enough that his Maharaja is going. And that's all he was concerned about.
People talk about, with great pride, about military history in India, but I don't get a sense they talk about World War I very much, or there isn't that remembrance.
Yeah, it is not talked about much.
Why is that?
Because it was not India's war. It was not India's war.
The average annual recruitment in the Indian Army before the war was around 15,000, but in the first year, there were nearly 80,000 new recruits. Troops weren't enlisted from across the whole of India, but from certain areas and castes, according to a theory of so-called martial races.
Martial race theory, it's a combination of social Darwinism and very savvy political thinking on part of the British.
Shantanu Das.
According to the martial race theory, some people were naturally, you know, more warlike. And
whatever that means.
Whatever that means, yeah. Absolutely. And they usually went for people from northern India and from Nepal, who are lighter complexioned, more solidly built, whereas a Bengali like me would be considered completely the opposite, an effeminate Bengali Babu.
And I'd be one of the martial races.
Absolutely, so it's a kind of gender reversal here.
I could probably have you in a fight though, Shantanu, to be fair. but this is, so they've tapped into something that this region already felt about themselves?
Or yes, in India already there existed these hierarchies and structures that some people were more martial, like the Sikhs, who pride in being a very martial community. So very cannily, the British people are using that social Darwinism to tap into these structures and they produce this theory of martial races.
Many of the private soldiers or sepoys came from poor farming families and even the basic salary of 11 rupees a month could be a tempting prospect.
People in the villages, they read all these things in the newspaper, local newspaper, who gave them detail that you must join the army for recruitment.
Retired Colonel Baljeet Singh June's grandfather, Gurdyal Singh, was a farmer in a small village near Delhi when war broke out.
Before the war, he was busy in only agricultural activities and the cattle rearing.
And how many men were recruited from your grandfather's village?
400 able-bodied joined.
400?
400. And 50% returned home.
Only 50?
Only 50.
How big was your village if 400 men were recruited?
I think there were 2,000 above.
So it's quite a large proportion of the village
that went. Large proportion of the village were they went away, all able-bodied, because very few people remained in the village. Women and elderly people, all were burden of agriculture, farming and cattle rearing came on the shoulder of ladies and elderly people.
How do you think your grandmother and your great-grandmother felt about the fact that the young men had been taken and gone to fight a war so far away?
They were very curious and they were feeling loneliness also, and they have no hope that may return, may not return.
The lamenting voices of women whose men left for the war have been preserved in the folk songs of Punjab.
Women used to get up early in the morning at 4 o'clock, and they used to gather all friends in the courtyard or in one house, and they used to spin.
Poet Amarjeet Chandan.
There's a long song called Challa, it's Darling. Challa Rune Gode, Mola Lam Trode, Sajana Kumode, Sun Dhol Jani, Allah Khairi Yani. Challa, I spin the cotton wool. May God stop the war and bring back my loved ones. Listen, my darling, return home safe. It's a diary, it's a journal, so to say, they kept in their mind. Or they shared with these feelings in the family or all these women with their friends when they gathered. It was a very personal thing, close to your heart. Challa aayi lari, sir utte khari, heavy daddy bhari, khali pe takeni hai. ਹੰਝੂ ਪਈ ਵਹਿਨੀ ਹੈ ਛੱਲਾ ਹੇਅਰ ਕਮਸ ਦਾ ਲੋਰੀ ਆਈ ਕੈਰੀ ਅ ਹੈਵੀ ਬਾਸਕਿਟ ਔਨ ਮਾਈ ਹੈਡ ਆਈ ਸਟੈਂਡ ਐਟ ਵੇਟ ਫੋਰ ਹਿਮ ਔਨ ਦਾ ਰੋਡ ਵਿਦ ਟੀਅਰਸ ਇਨ ਮਾਈ ਆਈਜ਼ ਸੋ ਸ਼ੀ ਇਜ਼ ਵੇਟਿੰਗ ਦਾ ਲੋਰੀ ਹੈਜ਼ ਅਰਾਈਵਡ ਅਦਰ ਸੋਲਜਰਸ ਮੇ ਬੀ ਅਦਰ ਮੈਨ ਦੇ ਹੈਵ ਕਮ ਬੈਕ ਬਟ ਨੋਟ ਹਰ ਹਸਬੈਂਡ
ਦਾ ਸੌਂਗਸ ਰਿਫਰ ਟੂ ਰੀਅਲ ਪਲੇਸਿਸ ਸੱਚ ਐਜ਼ ਬਾਜ਼ਰਾ ਇਨ ਮੈਸੋਪੋਟਾਮੀਆ roughly the area of modern-day Iraq, where the Indian Army was heavily deployed.
Holi holi tur gaddiye, mera mahi basre nu chalya. O train, depart ever so slowly, cause my loved one is on his way to Basra. Potholes on the roads, poor people's sons were killed in Basra. There are a few folk songs addressed to Germany. Mar jaye Germania, jine pehna to veer vichode. May you be wiped out, O Germany, who has torn the sisters apart from their brothers. Sadkaan te jhandiyan ni, bas kar German pehdiya, karo kar randiyan ni. Trees by the roadside, wicked Germany, stop the war. There are widows in every household. There are widows in every household. And remember, 62,000 Punjabis, they didn't go home.
I've traveled 50 kilometers south of Delhi now to a village on the outskirts.
Bonsi in Haryana was one of the many villages in the north tapped for new recruits.
We've come to a war memorial in the village of Bonsi because 145 men were sent from this one village to join the war efforts. And on the side of the road, there's a monument erected to the war dead. These are the names of all the places where the soldiers went to fight during the First World War. So you've got Afghanistan, you've got Mesopotamia, Persia, France. And on the memorial, there are 14 names of men who didn't return.
Gurdal Singh, Tulsi Singh, Surat Singh, Mukhtar Singh, Kundan Singh, Munshi Singh, Sirdal Singh.
The names are inscribed in stone, but what memory of the war survives among the people here?
Just right by the memorial, there's a group of old men sitting together. Maybe some of their grandfathers fought during the First World War.
Ozen? Apparently
there is a gentleman in the village, and we're now going to be escorted to his home. what I think of Indian villages. A road that's not actually a road, it's a dirt track. Just a little cluster of maybe about 10 or 12 houses.
Retired Subedar Om Prakash's father was in the army at the time.
Why do you think your father was fighting? Was he fighting for the British or was he fighting for Indians?
Fighting for the India, but during under British rule, because they, to serve in the army, it was a tradition. Because being a martial race, it was a sort of a part of become profession. Even illiterate people could join the army those days.
Although his father never spoke much about the war, the family had another connection.
Our uncle, he was a magistrate, honorary magistrate. He was getting money for the recruitment of one rather soldier, one sepoy. He was getting rupees too.
In the First World War, your uncle was an honorary magistrate and he was getting 2 rupees for every man he recruited.
Being a jaildar of this village.
A jaildar?
Jaildar, who had a plenty of lord, who has got a hold on the entire village rather. And he had a power over 12 villages rather. Because he was very loyal to the Britishers.
Down the road from Bonsi, at the Haryana Academy of History and Culture, local historian Professor Yadav told me more about this recruitment process.
There were local leaders, you see. Say, for instance, in this particular area, Captain Balbir Singh, he made substantial contribution to recruiting and all that. He enlisted 5,000 people.
How did he manage to get all these men to join? What methods did he use?
He would make an appeal to them. This is an honorable thing for us, the Yadav community, to join army in large numbers. There would be big gathering. First, a singer would come and he would sing some beautiful song, exhorting people to join army. Every gathering for recruitment, the commencement of the proceedings would start with this song. He says, "You are descendants of great warriors, and now is the time to show your mettle." King George has invited you to come join the army and fight the enemy.
Did I hear the names of certain countries as well?
The France, Basra, Germany. So this is a very passionate appeal. And when the people get stimulated, they come forward and they say, "Okay, I am a descendant of the warrior.
Sign me up.
And you enroll me in army and I am ready to go." So quite a few of them were aroused to such an extent that they joined army smiling.
I'm Anita Rani and in a moment, part two of India's Forgotten War.
100 women, half the world speaks.
Last October, the BBC brought together 100 women from around the world for a day of debate and discussion.
They all come from many parts of the world, they speak in many languages, and they have many stories. But they're all here today for one common goal.
1 year on, we'll look again at the risks, challenges, and opportunities faced by women every day in every country. We'll be linking up 100 women to continue the conversation, and you can hear what they have to say throughout the day on the 28th of October. We have interactive programs from Abuja, Islamabad, Delhi and London, and special reports from around the world examining the stories on women, by women, for everyone. 100 Women on the 28th of October on radio and online at bbcworldservice.com/100women.
I'm Anita Rani, and in a moment, part two of India's Forgotten War on the BBC World Service.
There are instances, based on magisterial inquiry reports, that they stopped the water of those who are not readily coming forward to join the army. Such horrible methods as stripping people naked and making them stand before their women folk.
That's India's Forgotten War with me, Anita Rani, on the BBC World Service.
BBC News with Zoe Diamond.
Iran has hanged a woman who was convicted of killing a man who allegedly tried to rape her. 26-year-old Rehani Jabari was executed despite a campaign in Iran and abroad urging a reprieve. The UN argued that her confession had been obtained under duress and she should have been given a retrial. The president of Mali says that he will do everything he can to avoid panic following the first confirmed case of Ebola in the country. A 2-year-old girl who came to Mali from Guinea died from the disease on Friday. In his weekly radio address, President Obama has urged Americans to be guided by facts rather than fear as they confront the threat of Ebola. Mr. Obama was speaking after it emerged that a doctor returning to New York from West Africa had contracted the disease. The president of Egypt, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, has said that the country is locked in a battle with jihadists for its existence, a day after more than 30 soldiers were killed in attacks in the Sinai Peninsula. In a live national address, surrounded by the country's top military chiefs, Mr. al-Sisi warned that a huge plot was being waged against Egypt by external forces. The Lebanese army is fighting Islamist gunmen in the northern city of Tripoli, where there's been sporadic unrest triggered by the Syrian conflict for several years. The army says that it's surrounded dozens of militants in the city's Old Market district. Tens of thousands of protesters have gathered in the Italian city of Rome to demonstrate against government plans to overhaul the country's labour market. Italy's centre-left prime minister wants to make it easier for companies to dismiss people. The Picasso Museum in Paris has reopened after a lengthy and expensive renovation programme. The building has been extensively redesigned, creating larger exhibition areas and bringing in more natural light. That's the BBC News.
I'm Anita Rani. This is part two of India's Forgotten War on the BBC World Service.
For the first time, these men who had grown up in these little villages, in these mud huts, they're going to Bombay, seeing the colonial city.
Dr. Shantanu Das is writing a book about India and the war.
They're getting onto the ship and then they land in Marseille. They're absolutely overwhelmed by the modernity of France. This sense of exhilaration, it just lasts only the first few months, and then they're shoved into the trenches.
I'm standing now on the firing platform.
Andrew Kerr's grandfather was a British officer with the Kashmir Rifles.
Look over the top to aim and fire your weapon.
Inside a model trench at Haileybury College in England, he described the conditions for the Indian Army in those early months.
The India Corps that came over in 1914 and 1915 went straight into the front line. They were dressed in clothes suitable for India, and as soon as the winter came on, they were totally underdressed for the wet North European climate, and they suffered terribly from the wet cold. They suffered lots of casualties from that, but remained stoically in action. One of the problems for the Indians was they didn't have a system of reinforcements. So once the casualties were taken, there weren't any replacements. As the Indians got weaker and weaker in numbers, the generals didn't reduce the frontage that a battalion had to occupy, or a brigade had to occupy. So they got ever more stretched.
Of the army which came from India, less than half remains. Very many have been killed. It is a terrible war. Of this there is no doubt only. Those escape with their lives who have lost their hands and feet. The English have made such things that I cannot explain them to you. When they fly in the air, they look like stars. I tell you, there is no place empty of corpses on which to put one's feet as in the Mahabharata. They have made a machine gun which scatters bullets like water. The Germans have invented a shell full of poison from the vapor of which one dies. If I meet my father, mother and sister again, it will be as if I have been granted a new life. The enemy is merciless. There is a river of blood flowing here. I have written only a little, but you can imagine the rest.
Many of the letters written by Indian troops, now held at the British Library, were translated into English and censored. But there is archive of an actual voice, now nearly 100 years old. Shantanu Das played me the record.
Oh, it's really moving.
It's very moving.
Yeah. He's talking about, he's in Germany, he talks about wanting to go back to eat the food of India.
Absolutely.
He says, if this man, because he talks about himself in the third person, if this man remains here, he will die. Who is he?
Iqbal Singh, he's referred to as just, in the sound archives, sound recording PK649.
So he just had a number?
Just a number, no name, no face. And it was done on the 11th of December, 1916. And it's part of the over 2,000 sound recordings that we have in the Humboldt Sound Archive. And they were done by the Royal Prussian Phonographic Commission between 1915 and 1916.
I'm really moved. I can't quite believe I'm hearing an actual voice. But he's talking about the land where he gets his ghee is the Punjab, and that's where my own family comes from. And it's really moving because I can actually understand what he's saying, because he's speaking Punjabi, but it's a very basic village Punjabi, and he's talking very simple sentences, but there's no doubt about what he's saying, which is, I want to go home. I want to taste the food of my land. If I remain here, I'll die here.
As word got back to India about captured prisoners and brutal trench warfare, not everyone was willing to sign up. Some local leaders resorted to extreme methods of persuasion. Professor Yadav.
They stopped the water of those who are not readily coming forward to join the army. And they rewarded people who were joining there. So to their fields, a lot of water was flowing and others were starved. Even such horrible methods were used as stripping people naked and making them stand before their women folk. People were kept in thorny bushes for hours and hours together, and unless they said, yes, I'm ready for enlistment, they were not let off.
So they were tortured and publicly humiliated?
Yes, yes, yes. And then people of no interest in military service were also enlisted in large number, resulting in large-scale desertions.
How many people deserted?
Yes, about 26,700 from Punjab.
Not everyone from India was sent to fight. Nearly 500,000 Indian non-combatants joined the war. They dug trenches, built railways and roads, cleaned out latrines, but there were also tailors, butchers, bakers, carpenters and cooks. In the Lushai Hills, modern-day Mizoram in northeast India, around 2,000 men were recruited for the labour corps.
This is some of the verses that were composed during the time of the First World War, the Great War, as Mizos call it.
Joy Pachwal from the Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi.
We wander further on and further west on roaring trains made by the Saab, we said. Saab essentially meaning the British. Huh? I dare not imagine children becoming orphans, that they without their fathers will have to roam the hills. It can't be right that we are sent forth to fight the Germans. There was a major send-off where they were sent off as warriors who would be fighting in the war. But when they go to France, they are, of course, part of the labor corps, which essentially meant that they were clearing the trenches, you know, the trenches that had been vacated by the Germans after a particular battle, essentially to pick up dead bodies and transport them wherever they needed to be transported.
Why were they prepared to volunteer? What would be the outcome for them? What were they gaining from it?
In the region, it was essentially barter economy that was taking place, and this was one way in which money was coming into the region. So it was not as a bargaining tool for freedom or anything of that sort. It's just that they felt that there was no other option.
Joy has also discovered some letters written by the Lushai men in Europe.
So you've loosely translated some of these letters, and these were written by the village people from the northeast, from France, sent back to India and published in a local newspaper.
Yeah.
So a young chap's written here, a very healthy place about France. No useless animals, no leeches, snakes, caterpillars, ants, mosquitoes, no tigers, bears or foxes either. However, many flies and huge rabbits. No useless animals. I like that. They made us sit in their homes, but we did not know their language. Wow, so they were brought into French homes.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Do we know how some of these men, how they felt about it? Here they are leaving their villages for the first time in their lives, and here they are confronting the absolute horror of war, having to deal with the dead bodies and picking up the remains and clearing up. Do we know what impact that had?
There is this overwhelming sense of support for King George at that point of time, and at the same time, you do get voices where, you know, they are reluctant to send people to fight another person's war as well.
The war had a big impact on India itself. Some men came back with new ideas about education and social structures. Military hospitals expanded to take in thousands of injured and sick troops from the Middle East. The major port cities of Karachi, Bombay and Calcutta became hives of activity too, as thousands of people boarded ships and Indian goods such as jute for sandbags, tea, rubber, cotton, leather, timber and steel were manufactured and exported. In the port city of Calcutta, the river and the railway still run past each other, as they did 100 years ago.
So just stepping off the road, across the railway track to the river, the huge Hooghly River in front of me. It was on the train that the recruits from the northeast villages, the hill tribes, would have come in.
Round the corner is a memorial to another group of men who came not from the north of India, but from around Bengal itself. Shantanu Das.
Just next to the river Hooghly lies this majestic monument to the 860 Lascars from Bengal and surrounding areas in India who died in the First World War.
Who were the Lascars?
The Lascars are seamen who had been serving in the European ships from the 16th century onwards. But during the First World War, there's a huge number of Lascars freshly recruited because they're taking up the place of the British sailors who have been now joining the British Marine Forces.
What were they doing?
They would be carrying heavy things to the ships. They would be helping with the upkeep of the ship. They were helping hands. The number of Lascars increased dramatically during the First World War, and by the end of the war, 20% of the British Marine Forces were comprised of Lascars. That's a huge number, 20%. I still remember the haunting voice of a Muslim Lascar from the Sound Archives, where he says how he was captured. He was in a German ship, and suddenly he was captured, and then he's in the prisoner of war camp, and then he gives this detailed account of the food he's given.
Listen, brother, he says, we ate fat, wholemeal wheat, flour, potatoes, butter, rice, and sardine fish for 50 days.
Food is so important to these people. It's a link back to their home. It reminds them of the people they had left behind. And it's really sad because many of them would have died on sea. Perhaps they'd have been thrown overboard when they died. So it's really particularly moving that the Lascars are commemorated next to the water on which they set sail and voyaged to these hearts of whiteness, in fact, to witness the horror of Western warfare.
We're still in Calcutta, but we've jumped in a car. We're travelling south of the city to find a family that are part of Shantanu's family. They have the same surname, Das, and they were involved in the war in a very different way. Their father was a doctor during World War I. How many Indian doctors were there?
There were quite a few, and even in Calcutta itself, I've come across over the last 1 or 2 years at least a dozen of Indian doctors who served both in France and in Mesopotamia.
Are we here?
Medicine Corner.
Perfect.
See, this is father in his army uniform. This is father when he passed away.
grandfather of the house.
He was a doctor before, then he went to England, got his IMS, that is the Indian Medical Service, and then he went into the war.
Captain Manindranath Das's son and daughter-in-law, Dr. and Mrs. Das, have a collection of objects from their late father's time in the war.
Now, we have a little glass bottle here. Do we know what tipple would have been in this glass
brandy.
Bottle?
Brandy, absolutely.
I, you know, I asked Daddy that you used to take brandy, Baba. He said we had to. That's the time he told me that for 2 weeks we are at the front. Yes. No bath, nothing, and what is mud and what is blood? You can't differentiate.
Captain Das also left written accounts, including one describing a battle between the British and the Ottoman Turks.
The Turkish suddenly advanced. His own regiment ran away. He pretended that he was a dead person, and exactly like a dead body, he laid there for a long time. And I have asked him that, what did you do? He said, they were just marching over our bodies. They jumped on our back, they poked us with their bayonets. You know, he just said, Ami pore roilam, I just lay there. And then they went away. All these people, they are dying. I asked Daddy, what did you do then? He said, no, you see what I did. There were so many bodies lying about, lifeless. So I took all their canteens and those medicine packs and food, whatever was there. And with that, I started treating these people. This courage, with the least regard for his own life, earned him the military cross.
I had my breakfast at 1 p.m. Then I had a haircut.
Jatindra Pratap Singh is one of a new generation exploring his connection to the war.
Then read my Sri Ramayan.
Then, so he was reading.
He used to read daily the Ramayan ji, like the holy book.
He recently discovered a diary written by his great grandfather, Takur Hukam Singh, an Indian officer with the Jaipur State Forces, while he was stationed in Mesopotamia.
So when your great-grandfather was fighting alongside the British as an officer, was he treated equally?
Once he mentioned an incident there in the diary, he writes, these Europeans, they always consider you inferior, be it a Raja or anybody, they'll treat you inferior only.
16th January 1918. Last night I noticed a friction which Europeans always have between Indian and themselves. Although I had a pass of a passage of British officer, I asked the British railway clerk if there is any first-class carriage on this train. He replied, no.
After discovering that there was in fact a half-empty first-class carriage, Hukam Singh asked the clerk again, who told him this time that it was full.
It stuck to my mind that it is a fact that European never gives the respect to the Indian even if he is a Raja. He spoke to me like that the carriage was full, because he thought that I was not any more good than those servants, though he knew that I was holding a British rank.
Indian troops suffered other inequalities, notably the punishment of flogging, being beaten or lashed, an option which was retained for the Indian Army until 1920, despite having been abolished among British troops nearly 40 years earlier. In Calcutta, some Indian intellectuals at the time were beginning to discuss such inequalities and the relationship between the two countries.
We're standing on College Street, and perfectly named, because it's just stall after stall after stall of bookshops.
Absolutely, and this is unique in India, and right in front of us is Presidency College, Calcutta.
Shantanu Das.
And then on the right-hand side is the coffee house, where many of the revolutionary activities of India were plotted.
So you've brought me into the coffee shop, and it is, how can I describe this, classic old colonial building, double-heighted, huge ceilings, shuttered windows, tables everywhere.
No.
I can imagine it must have been like this 100 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. This is the heartland of middle-class Bengali culture.
So what would have been happening here during the war?
I think there'd be a sense of mixed emotion. On one hand, there'd be a tremendous sense of excitement of India being put on the world map. For the first time in history, Indians were allowed to fight in Europe, something that was denied to the Maoris or the Caribbeans. So there'd be a tremendous sense of pride and excitement. On the other hand, it is also the beginning of the nationalist movement. So it's a turning point in the national consciousness.
Migrant labourers who had emigrated to North America from Punjab were also beginning to question the status quo. Historian Gajendra Singh.
1913, you begin to have the formation of what's called the Hindustani Association of the Pacific Coast. And it begins to publish a newspaper called Gadar. And Gadar is a word that translates from Urdu as mutiny or rebellion or struggle, as in a personal struggle. The Gadar newspaper from December 1913 begins to take a line that we need to return to India, to involve ourselves in armed revolution. Flags are printed, leaflets, contact is made with several regiments across North India, preparing for them to mutiny on the signal. Yeah. Eventually a rising is fixed the 12th of February 1915, based in Lahore, and then is meant to sweep out across India, and because it's time of war, we can throw the British out.
British intelligence uncovered the plan before any uprising occurred, but the government also stepped up its powers of control.
Ordinances are passed suspending all jurisprudence, of completely limiting freedom of the press, of imposing curfews on most inner cities after 8 p.m, of limiting freedom of assembly so men can't gather together more than five at a time. Gadar is a spectacular failure, but there's always this fear of constant, imminent imperial decline. And that's what you have in the First World War. You have this deep anxiety.
Against this backdrop of colonial anxiety, women with connections to the British Raj tried to gain support for the war among local communities. Historian Sarah Ansari.
There was a big effort, for example, to get women, like they did back in Britain, to knit and sew for the troops. The functions that they put on depended on Indian women participating, donating things like jewellery or other items for sales, to buy comforts, as they were known, for Indian and British troops. So whether that was cigarettes, Christmas cakes, playing cards or spiced delicacies for the Indian troops, you know, this is what they were putting the money towards.
One surprisingly vocal supporter of India's cooperation throughout the war years was Gandhi.
What you've got here, you've got Gandhiji's...
At the Haryana Academy, Professor Yadav has a collection of his speeches encouraging recruitment.
This is quite near the end of the war. This is June 1918. So they were still putting appeals out for men to join.
That is the period when they needed more recruits. The situation in Europe was pretty dangerous at that time. They were desperately needing manpower and all that. They were appealing, send half a million men or something like that. So Gandhiji said, yes, this is the time you should join.
And this is quite interesting. In this speech, he says, our meaning of home rule is that we should become partners in the empire. If every village gives at least 20 men on their return from the war, they will be living bulwarks of their village. Yes. So he is saying, go for it. Put men forward and we will get what we want in return, which is home rule.
Home rule we will get.
With the declaration of an armistice on November the 11th, 1918, the need for mass recruitment in India ended. Men like Gurdyal Singh returned home after many years away. His great-great-grandson, Abhimanyu Jun.
As he came back, the village was almost deserted except for a few families. 400 men had gone there, so families of those 400 men were holding on to the hope that someday their men will return. The village suffered many drought conditions, frequent flooding, causing terrible damage to the livestock and even the loss of and material. But somehow, just for basic survival, they were able to manage with, you know, agriculture activities. That's all.
And did the British Army support your great-great-grandfather once he was home?
Well, I'm really sorry to say there was no support provided from any level, not even administrative level. They were given just menial wages. At the time of their release, they were provided with silver and gold coins. But honestly speaking, at a personal level, I don't think that's sufficient justice.
Around 8% of India's national income went towards the war effort every year. Some manufacturers had made a lot of money, but many of the working classes suffered higher prices and food shortages as vital crops were being exported. Economist Amir Bagchi.
The Gallipoli campaign had failed and Britain had a desperate need for wheat in 1918. And that's where India played an extremely large role at the cost of a large famine, which has gone unrecorded.
Where did this famine take place?
The famine took place practically all over India. Wheat production declined because of harvest failures. And then the Indian wheat exports were doubled in 1918. Rice production also declined. And rice was being exported during the war years to Asian countries.
So they were starving. So they literally starved to death.
Exactly.
Had India not had to go to war, would any of this happened?
If India had not gone in for the war, there would not have been this kind of death all over India.
There was a large hidden cost for India. But what about the promise of political change, which had driven much of the support for the war? The British government in India did come up with some new legislation, the Montagu-Chelmsford reforms. Rana Chena.
They didn't at all satisfy Indian political opinion. The colonial authorities had no intention of living up to the kind of promises that they had made. And when there was agitation against this perceived letdown, they came out with a very suppressive legislation called the Rowlatt Act. And that again led to widespread discontentment and agitation.
Indians thought that because of their tremendous contribution to the war, they would be given greater political autonomy. And instead, there was a tightening of grip. So the soldiers from the Punjab, who had served in different battles, they come back only to feel the noose tightening around them.
In April 1919, a peaceful political protest in the Punjabi city of Amritsar coincided with a popular religious festival. When a large group gathered for the occasion in Jallianwala Bagh, a public square, a British officer, General Dyer, ordered soldiers to open fire. It was harsh payment for a population which had seen so many of its people fighting alongside Britain less than 6 months earlier.
It's perhaps the most brutal event in the colonial rule, and there was absolute mayhem and bloodshed. And the figures vary from 400 to 2,000 killed. It makes the headlines all around the world. People are absolutely horrified. And after that, we have Gandhi non-cooperation movement, and the road leads to the independence movement.
It's hardly surprising that the First World War in India has been eclipsed by what came next in the country's history. That a colonial war commemorated in a big way in Britain is remembered quite differently in post-independence India. But it did have an impact here. On the towns and villages affected by recruitment, famine and disease, on the ports and railways, hospitals and industries, and on the men themselves. Those who made it back, and those who didn't. India's Forgotten War was presented by Anita Rani and produced by Joe Wheeler. It's a freewheel production for the BBC World Service.